Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 40, which features the keynote and panels of a one-day symposium on the continuities and disruptions in management and work in the gig economy, which took place on the 15th of December in Sussex University. The symposium was partially funded by the Society for the Advancement of Management Studies. The symposium brought together people from a variety of areas, such as organizational studies, information systems, industrial relations, anthropology, sociology, political science, and others interested in talking about the gig economy and how it produces changes in work and management dynamics. This first part of the episode features the keynote by Professor Natalia Levina from NYU, entitled Crowdsourcing Knowledge Work, Meaning and Firm Boundary in the Digital Age. In the next weeks, we will release two panel discussions from the symposium.
Thank you very much for inviting me to this exciting event. I find this conversation between old theories and new phenomena very exciting. While I'm not a regular listener of the podcast only because of the time constraints, I am fascinated by the kind of stuff you guys do. And it was a pleasure to have Pedro visit us in New York. And I see three other of our visitors in the audience, Greta and Marika, and I think there is a reason why you're all in the same room. Okay, so I think I'm going to kind of like, to some degree, violate what Mitris just said, because I will be speaking for about half an hour to an hour, which was allocated to me. But then hopefully what I talk about will facilitate some good conversations. And I know when people talk about gig economy, they tend to focus on Ubers, Airbnbs, and such. And I have not studied them. I respect people who do. I tend to look at work and in particular knowledge work. And so that's the part of the gig economy that I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to focus my talk specifically on the question of firm boundaries. I hope you all agree it's one of the old questions that has been asked for, I would say, almost 100 years studying with Ronald Coase. And the question is, and if not earlier, why sort of firms exist? The way this question is usually postulated in economic discussion is sort of along the lines of why has a large part of economic activity been conducted inside hierarchical organizational hierarchical firms rather than through market contracts. And you would notice here sort of a bias towards market contracts because market contracts in economics are seen as efficient way of conducting transactions. And I'm going to illustrate this with a little picture. So I'm going to put on sort of economist or efficiency hat for the next few slides. And the idea here is that economists are, I believe, the first sort of, at least organizational economists, to kind of ask the questions this way. And they see firms and markets as two different governance modes of work or economic activity. And the markets are seen as generally being governed by contracts. And I'm using the terms clients and provider here just because it makes the language easier. That's not the terms they generally use. Where the idea is that the client controls what work is done and the provider controls how to do the work. Now, anybody who has ever seen a real, you know, contractual relationship as knowledge work knows that's not how it's done, but this is the ideal type of governance that the economists imagine happens. And, you know, I use here an illustration of a market. Sort of here, you are in a food market, you come and you buy these wonderful peaches. You really have no idea how they were produced. So this metaphor of buying food in the market is probably the clearest of how economists tend to think about markets. You know, and the opposition of this is, and I might say it took me like half an hour to find a decent picture from the farming industry to illustrate it, which I wonder why. And that in an internal organization, managers control what is done and managers control how it's done and specifically to work. And the reason I picked this illustration is because that's sort of how economists think about managers, right? Managers do nothing, right? They supervise. And there is a lot of waste in that supervision. You know, the hierarchical structure is costly. In this particular picture, the there's like one person working and five observing, which we might say sometimes we see organizations that we study that are like that. Hopefully not all of them are like that. But there is a lot of control, right? You see exactly what is picked up. You see what fertilizers are used. You see sort of whether the bad fruit is sorted out from the good fruit. And, you know, you can see much more, right? So that's the metaphor that I think economists go with. And I drew it as a continuum because there are sort of in-between variants, which we'll talk about. So next I'm going to, you know, in the spirit of your podcast, go through four theories, grand theories that existed way before gig economy, to talk about what sort of the idea of firm versus markets are. So the first, and it's not one theory, it's three different theories, but I think they sort of say very similar things to the question we're posing, and that is transaction cost economics, and, you know, it's sisters slash brothers, probably brothers, both of them. It's like self-animated. Moving this, it is property rights and incomplete contract theories. And as you probably know, if you paid attention to this, this is like three Nobel Prizes, right, in the last 10 years. So Williamson and Hart and Moore. So their answer is more or less that firms exist to reduce the cost of opportunistic behavior through hierarchical supervision, promotion, and asset ownership. Now, I'm not going to go into depth into issues like specific investment. You know, it will take us another hour to get through the theory. But like the idea is you cannot write a good contract in certain conditions. And those certain conditions are when there is a lot of uncertainty as to what's going to happen in the future and where there's a lot of specific investment into the relationship. That's basically what they say. And because you cannot write a good contract that is enforceable easily in an institutional environment in which the firms operate, you kind of need other ways of aligning incentives. So I'm going to call this theory as focusing primarily on cooperation, and cooperation being alignment of incentives in creating trust. And I'm sure later in the day people will talk a lot about how trust is created with the gig economy. But basically, that's the idea of this kind of set of theories. And so they say you need the firm to monitor, supervise, and promote. The second theory that is often overlooked nowadays, like if you just randomly pick up an article about firm boundaries, you tend to just see two out of three of the theories I'm going to talk about, but it's very, very important. And that's information processing theory. The organizational scholars in the room recognize it as like Galbraith, but there is a huge part of organizational economics that is to this day advancing and developing the theory, and it's exemplified in the work of Timothy Van Zandt at INSEAD, and it's very mathematical, and it's still information processing theory. Just to be sure, I googled, you know, Timothy Van Zandt's web page today, and he has like tons and tons of new articles about the theory. So what this does is says firms exist to reduce cost and improve quality of processing information through hierarchical and lateral coordination. Now, you would say, why economists are doing it? Well, because this is a branch of economics that has to do with bounded rationality, and it kind of, you know, takes its roots in Simonian approaches to organizations, and it argues that with bounded rationality, any one person cannot process all the information in the environment, so you need many people. But when you have many people, you have coordination problems, and so you need managers. The key role of managers is to basically, you know, decide whose information is better and how it compares, and to coordinate activity of acquiring environmental information. Everything is environmental, right? The environment gives you stuff. You process it and you decide which, you know, what's good for decision making. So I call it the coordination perspective because it's about aligning activities and aggregating information for good decision making. To combat, the key problem here is bounded rationality. On the prior page, the key problem was, you know, opportunity seeking with guile. Everybody is for themselves, right? This one is like, just can't do it, like not enough processing power. And so the manager is here listening, kind of listening and making decisions, hopefully. Okay. And the one we probably know the best in this room, given whom I know in this room, and people coming from Warwick and from Amsterdam, the Centers for Studying Knowledge Work and others I've encountered over the years, the knowledge-based view of the firm, which posits its firm exists to enable knowledge production through shared identity, culture, and relationships. Now, this is my formulation. I mean, you see it under recombinative capabilities and other like fancy words, but basically this is the one that says firms exist to create social structures for integrating knowledge. And I call it the collaboration one because it is about synergistic integration of diverse expertise, and hopefully these people actually result, produce something innovative, right? So the key problem that this is trying to solve is diversity of expertise and the need to talk across boundaries, which, if you know my work, sort of often is placed in that tradition. Okay. So is that it? I said four, but I listed three, right? So there is one more and theory which sort of usually doesn't come in at all in the discussions that you would see in, let's say, outsourcing literature, which I'm familiar with. And that's institutional theory, in that it does come in, but only sort of marginally, and not even anymore, because outsourcing became institutionalized. And I think we should be clear that this theory doesn't answer exactly the same question as the other ones. The other ones say why firms exist for efficiency reasons. They're solving a problem, right? This kind of says why do firms almost continue to exist? And it's because they become legitimate form of organizing work, and there is institutionalization, and through, you know, the key term they like is managerial capitalism as an institution, making employment relationship its own institution and the norm, right? So I didn't have the same kind of picture, just to make sure it's a different type of theory. So it's sort of this very, you know, Kafkaesque, right? Like people just copying for no good reason potentially each other, and creating this large organizations that many people don't like working in. And in fact, just to, you know, when I was thinking about this, like, I have some colleagues who are computer scientists and sort of build systems, and sometimes they say the whole point of their work is to get rid of managers as an institutional legacy that they don't need. The dream is to do work without managers in this, as efficiently, with addressing the other three problems as managers. They see this picture very much as the one with my peach farm, five people watching one person working. We want to get rid of the five and just need someone. Okay, so, you know, you probably expected this next question given the topic of the symposium, and that is, do we still need the firm, right? So these are all traditional theories, and they say firms exist, and they exist for reason. I'm going to call it IT because I come from information systems field, but you can call it digitization, you can call it technology. IT is information technology, so I'm going to stick to the old terms at least. That's allowed for today, right? So, and the argument is IT reduces the cost and improves the quality of at least corporate. So IT reduces the cost and improves the quality of cooperation, meaning it aligns and it allows people to align incentives through contracts. You know, if you think about it in purely theoretical terms, it makes contracts more complete and easier to enforce, right? This is what this grant incomplete contract people would say. And the key way it does it is actually not through smart contracts, which are newer, right? Or even in an Upwork case, sort of contracts executed through escrows online, but rather through product modularization. The key driver of this is actually the fact that we can now make work more modular and reduce the need for specific investment, right? Because a lot of Williamsonian thinking depends on specific investment. So if you have technology, makes more work more modular and more standard, standard is another keyword, right? Then you don't need as much specific investment. So, you know, picking up somebody in an Uber, you know, is a very standard thing if you know exactly where to pick them up. And I'm using Mechanical Turk here because I promised I'll be focusing on knowledge work as opposed to Uber and Airbnb, so I have to stick to my own agenda here. And you could see how, you know, tagging pictures or translating pieces of text in the past was more ambiguous and required a lot more specific knowledge. Now that we put it in a system and we have this automatic execution of payment if the work is done and automatic monitoring, the contract monitoring is a big part of what sort of was the problem in the past with contract completion, right? If work is done and it's done well, an Amazon Mechanical Turk worker gets paid. If it's not done, they don't get paid, right? So this is sort of, and the work is so modularized that you take, my favorite example of what could be done in Mechanical Turk comes from 4 years ago. It's a collective intelligence conference. It was a presentation where somebody took a complex, you know, turbine design problem in engineering that several master students in engineering in this field would take a couple of days to solve, and modularized it to the degree that Mechanical Turk could solve the pieces so that it put it back together and showed that the quality was the same. That's sort of the idea. So next, you know, let's talk about coordination. And I could use open source here for anything. Obviously, if you've been keeping track of my slides, but I'm going to use it specifically for coordination because it's so clear that with GitHub, you can coordinate the efforts of thousands and millions of people easily. And then as long as they are able to communicate and, you know, not redo each other's work without the need for it. Like sometimes in open source, you have forking and sort of people working in parallel, but there is sort of what you want them to do. They're not just doing this because they can't coordinate. So the GitHub and the joint shared databases solve this coordination problem, and internet allows people to communicate, and there is FAQs and Q&As, and everything becomes sort of seamlessly synchronized. And finally, you know, IT reduces and improves the quality of collaboration. And I'm going to use Wikipedia for this because if the whole promise of knowledge-based view of the firm is that, you know, firms are better at producing knowledge, then by definition, right, Wikipedia is production of knowledge, not necessarily innovation, but that's debatable. And firms, you know, a Wikipedia is really, really good at that, better than most dictionaries we know that have been produced. And what enables it is online communities, social media that helps people create joint identity and relationships, culture, and the technology that allows for deep deliberation and of diverse perspectives. So I do want to emphasize this part of Wikipedia. So if you're not familiar with Jerry Keynes and Marshak's work on this, they show so beautifully how very controversial topics such as, you know, an article on autism, or, you know, if you want to go to somebody else, not Jerry's work, like an article on Nazism, right, that has a lot of diversity of perspectives, gets shaped through this deep deliberation of Wikipedia to the degree that people of diverse perspectives can agree on it and we can learn something from it. So this argument is not mine, right? Like that, I want to be 100% clear on this. This is not like my news here, contribution to science. It's been made by Tom Malone, Joanne Yates, and Joe Benjamin in 1986 is when they wrote the paper. In 1987 is when they published it. And this is pretty amazing, I think. If you think in 1987, what's the technologies we had? We had like email, and only worked on like Unix servers, right? There's no real PCs in anybody's homes in 87. You know, this is, so them being able to say, look, technology is going to shift economic activities from firms to markets. And I needed to copy it because I always get confused as to how they drew it. But basically, they are only using here information processing theory and a little bit of transaction cost economics. And they're saying, you know, there's going to be more market activity through electronic markets. Electronic markets are going to dominate electronic hierarchies. And what's important here, they are very, you know, sort of smart and diligent people. They do say that there will be electronic hierarchies. They're not making a wrong comparison here between electronics markets and traditional firms. They're saying some things are actually going to improve within the traditional firms as well, within electronic communication. But overall, we see this movement towards markets, right? It's also to that level like this, because basically they're showing there's more activity going to be conducted in the market. And, you know, people say, well, this is crazy, right? Where is the proof? The proof is in empirical papers that followed in 94. And by the way, if you're wondering, this is a paper that made Eric Brynjolfsson famous. And that's Brynjolfsson, Malone, Gilbakhtani, and Campbell. That is an empirical paper that looks at whether over the last 10, I don't remember the exact number of years, the size of the firms increased or decreased, and the answer is yes to the question that the paper title does information technology lead to smaller firms. So we have both theoretical and empirical kind of claim here, and you would say, you know, this was 1980s, 90s. Now we know, right? All this economic activity that is conducted by independent contractors and small firms, it's nice to have this said earlier, but by you know, it's no longer even necessary to do any of this, right? Well, yes, because we're in this room, but just for a second, think about all the firms we know and how big are they or how small are they, right? So if you start thinking about it today, it's not so clear that we live in a society where only small firms exist interacting through contracts. You know, large banks, for one, right, are not so small. Platforms themselves, Ubers and Lyfts and Airbnbs and Upworks, right? They're not so small. I mean, they're small in terms of number of employees, but in terms of the capital they have, in terms of the dominance they have, the Facebooks, the Googles. So
So something doesn't add up, right? Like if you think about it, something is not adding up in terms of we are going to be living in a society with only small firms interacting in contracts. So it's possible that we're living through a transition, right? In which case, you know, eventually we'll figure out how to be a distributed Google, right? We'll be, figure out how to use Upwork to create, you know, Google search. It's possible. So, it or it's possible that this some we are not accounting for something. And so just to make us think about, let's take like a vote for a second. And on this question, do we still need firms today to do knowledge work? Or maybe make it not today, make it in 10 years, because today you kind of do in 20 years. In a digital world, do we still have a use for, and by firms, I don't mean the people who pay for our health insurance in America. I mean the organizing of knowledge work through hierarchical organization that is based on employment and managerial capitalism. That's just, when I do this with wide and non-academic audiences, my first person who raises a hand in America says, I need it for health insurance. So like you guys here. So let's take this aside, and many of my colleagues talk to this problems that we have now with people whose benefits in the gig economy. But for organizing knowledge work from the standpoint of the three traditions don't talk at all about benefits, right? They talk about, you know, incentives, they talk about information processing, they talk about collaboration. So with that, just if you're brave enough to vote here, do we need firms to do knowledge work long term? Yes? Not everybody. Okay, that's great. So I'm not going to ask for no, but I'm going to take the no hand as an implicit vote for no. That's what we do, right? This is not clear, right? And I do, you know, especially technologists, people who buy into top coders, get, you know, Kaggles, Upworks, they, you know, we don't, right? It's a transition. We're going to figure out how to do all that we need to do through this and look at these wonderful examples of Linux, look at these wonderful examples of Wikipedia. We are able to do knowledge work well online. Let me try to put a perspective on it. And surprise, it's going to be a boundary perspective. If you guys know my work, I'm going to talk about boundaries. So I'm going to talk about boundaries, not of the firm, but of expertise. Because the boundary of the firm question gets conflated with the boundaries of expertise question. And as a result, we kind of get mixed up. And the boundaries of the firm is the question we're debating, whereas the boundaries of expertise, I would propose, are out there. Like, we are not all talking the same language. We're not publishing in the same journals. It's wonderful that you guys collected together people who are not publishing in the same journals. And we are studying different phenomena. And I don't mean here Carlyle's knowledge boundaries, because that gets us to a higher level of sophistication than I want to. I'm just talking about differences in what we know. That's all. And so if I start thinking about boundaries of the firm in this way, of course, I'm kind of close to the knowledge-based view of the firm tradition, but I want to extend it a little bit. The traditional firm is sort of designed whether by design or emergently, but at the end of the day, it spans specific domain boundaries. If you think about the firms that do it well, like, I mean, I would propose from reading about Apple, it's really, really good at spanning the technology design boundary, right? And it's so hard to replicate. You know, how much has Microsoft been trying to replicate this one type of boundary spanning to design stuff that we like? Sorry if anybody loves Microsoft technology. But, you know, it's sort of one boundary so hard to span. If you think of other companies, you know, you could start thinking about which boundaries do they span really, really well, the knowledge kind of companies. And then we have a movement over, you know, the last, I don't know how many years, but maybe 20, 30, at least in my studies of information technology outsourcing, the movement to relational contracts, which is this in-between state between markets and hierarchies, where you have, if you guys are more familiar with the term alliances, right? So that's what would come in here, where you have different firms working together, where the firm is no longer the key mechanism, spanning usually a particular type of boundary. And I'm going to use the examples that, again, I'm familiar with would be technology contracting, where a vendor has deep technical expertise and a client has some sort of business expertise, and they're working together. And the reason why they're not working on this same hierarchical umbrella usually has to do with knowledge-based view of the firm, because for a while they've been developing deep expertise in one domain, and to develop the expertise across those two different domains takes many, many years. And so as a result, they contract for that expertise and are able to somehow work across boundaries, which, by the way, debunks the notion that the firm is one and only mechanism for spanning knowledge boundaries. And again, I'm not the first one to say that. I think the best argument for it I've seen was in the introduction of the special issue of organizational science and knowledge in organizations. And I think it was Grandori and Kogut. And they say, like, look, we don't have any empirical evidence that you cannot span knowledge boundaries outside the firm effectively for collaboration and innovation. So we already debunked this. So basically, now we have this new form of organizing where the idea is, and we'll talk about how the platforms really implement it, is that we're dealing not just with a lot of boundaries, we're dealing with unknown boundaries. That's a very different proposition, right? Because in the past we said, well, technology and finance firms are going to work together. They know more or less which knowledge boundaries they need to span. Here, the whole organization was designed to spell design and technical boundaries. Now we have a wide variety of sort of hardly known or at least not predefined boundaries. And even if the platforms are geared towards spanning a particular one, let's say Top Coder is all about coding or algorithms, right? So you could say, well, that's not unknown. At the end of the day, who shows up is unknown. And we don't know exactly who's showing up and how. What do they know. Unlike an organization where we know who we employed or who we hired. So now I'm going to go through three cases that I know directly from, you know, engaging in some empirical work, and some of it is published, some of it is not published, of this sort of pretty prominent knowledge work gig economy places, so crowdsourcing of knowledge work, where something went wrong, and one of our three theories can tell us what pretty easily. And the first one is Quirky. So how many people have heard of Quirky? So Quirky is this website where the idea was the user-driven innovation on steroids, right? So it's a place where if you have an idea for a home gadget, a better power connector. So one of their famous products is this power surge protector that bends, right? Because you know how often we cannot stick all the devices we need into a surge protector because it's straight. And so the various power adapters are like in each other's way. So they invented a surge protector that sort of bends on an angle. It seems so simple, but this is $1 million business. And it was proposed by a design student from, you know, like a real student, an undergrad. And he made $1 million, and they made many more $1 million. And in the US, it would be sold in, you know, big chains like Bed Bath & Beyond and so on. So beautiful story, right? So this crowd-based innovation. And what they do is they say anybody could propose any ideas, at least historically. And then we would have, you know, this ideas proposals online, clear and transparent. And we would use initially the community to filter which of those ideas are useful and good. And later they moved on to using open forums, videotaped panels that you could see online or go and attend. And they serve you free food if you want to go and attend it, like full transparency in reducing the submissions towards like something that they would consider further. And then they would develop it, meaning, you know, before and between invention and product on the shelves, which, you know, being a person who almost never studies physical stuff, I didn't realize how much is like called development, where you actually make sure the cords are aligned and which materials you use. And like people engineering school are nodding their heads, like there is a lot of work there. There is legal work, right? You have to make sure somebody else hasn't invented it and that it's like not violating the legal codes. Especially for power cords, like there is actually regulation as to what you can and cannot do with electricity. And they have to develop, manufacture it, and they have to sell it, right? So, and for that, initially they were paying the inventor 7% royalty. Over time, it went down to 4.2%. But even with 2% or 4%, it's a lot of money. And then they had this collaborative model where anybody in the community could suggest improvements while the product was still being ideated. And these people will get money if the product is actually put on the shelf. So this truly works for collaboration. So it seems great, right? So you get this funnel, humongous funnel of ideas, and you have this vetting of ideas by the crowd of users. And Greta and I were once in that evaluation session, and there were lots of different people. And like Gabby, who is my daughter over there, watched it online if she wanted to, and she could type in her comments. And so, and like, it's truly transparent. Yeah. So once I said I couldn't take my kids to this evaluation session, and they saw kids in the audience. And like, next thing I know is a text from the kids saying, "Mom, you said there'll be no kids there. They're there. They're eating this idea." All transparency, right? So you basically end up with this sort of interesting machinery of how to produce things in a different way now. So you have to keep in mind, what was the old way? The old-fashioned way of doing this was that you had an R&D, a creative group, that proposed these ideas by observing the market, hopefully looking at some users. And then these people would propose something. There would be like relatively few ideas proposed and very, very long vetting process. And usually the firms would produce one or two products a year, right? Somebody, like, whom are they competing with? It would be P&Gs of this world, right? Or GEs of this world. So they're producing very few products. And these products, you know, sometimes met consumer needs, sometimes they didn't. So they fast forward this by saying, well, we're only going to do things that people find valuable in the ideation stage. Okay, so I don't know. You probably haven't heard of Quirky because it went bankrupt last summer, right? So, and a few years before it went bankrupt, so it's 2014 is at the time of boom years, 3,000 ideas were submitted weekly, right? That's the funnel. Some of them would be vetted by community to some degree, but basically they had a whole army of people evaluating the submissions, and they would reduce it to two that would sort of be going to the developer. You know, you can read in my slide, there is a huge incentive misalignment problem. This is like, you know, Williamson would be very happy to see this example because, you know, what is it? It's all about incentives. Incentives are not aligned at all here because the inventor takes almost no risk. You know, the only risk inventor takes is revealing a super valuable idea from which they potentially could make more money by copywriting or patenting it themselves. But a lot of the cost of this patenting copyright is huge. The access to capital to manufacture and develop the idea is also huge. The chances of people actually doing, you know, truly losing value are very, very small. And if you had some really deep invention, like, let's say, of the kind of inventions that... Right, let's say, right, where there's a lot of IP, right? Then you're not going to put it there anyway, because you don't believe that these people are in position to evaluate it correctly, right? You know, you're going to have a scooter with a motor, right? These people are not likely to say this is the best thing that I invented for all the reasons we know Segway had trouble gaining momentum. But at the end of the day, so here we have cooperation issue, and not surprising to many people who have seen them. And by the way, this picture is like right next to, was part of their ads right next to my building where I live. And it says, the world's least important CEO is never too busy to take your call. And the whole idea of this particular CEO was that CEOs are a waste of like energy, right? He says, I am the inventor. Everybody should be the inventor. Basically, this is the guy who invented Mobius, the batteries that you attach to make your iPhones last longer. So that's how he made the initial money to do this stuff. But he's believed at 16 he invented it in his parents' garage, the usual story, that like you need to enable this. But it doesn't work if all the incentives are not aligned. He borrowed money from his parents and promised to return the money, and he did. And like it's a very different incentive system from the one he created for this company. And we can talk about how crowdfunding fixed some of it, which is a natural thing probably going in your head. So Upwork, I believe, will be talked about more later in the afternoon. And I will also talk about it myself a little bit. I'm going to focus specifically on hiring programmers, developers. And it has done everything it can and more in reducing the coordination problem, right? Our second problem. It also has done a lot to align incentives, but this is sort of done in several places. But one of the reasons Upwork works when it works is because it makes coordination so easy. You go, you search for the worker you need. I am a big user of Upwork. I use them a lot in my own tasks. And so you broadcast the tasks that you need done. You select contractors for bidding on this task. And once you have contracted, which is what Williamson takes care of, you coordinating work through electronic means, through project rooms, through email, etc., etc. So the coordination of work should be figured out. But if you go back a little bit to what I mentioned, the idea of coordinating workers, and that's, by the way, Malone's other big line of research, Tom Malone's sort of this coordination with Kevin Crossman, the work on coordination. The biggest aspect of coordination is being able to know when one task is done and the next task begins. So should be fine. Like, how does Upwork accomplish it? It has deadlines, right? You say, I need my paper proofread, which is how I often use it, by such and such date because I have a paper submission deadline and I'm scheduling it a couple of days beforehand so that I, you know, have it back and have time to look at the corrections made by the editor. All right. Sounds great, right? What's the problem? The problem is the kind of work that this is contracting for is creative and ambiguous. And so the case study I'm going to mention in the afternoon panel is about what looks like vanilla web development, something that Upwork supposedly is. But when you're dealing with technology, especially with newer technology, you end up with nobody being able to estimate when work truly can get done. You know, bugs, you know, if you have a program, it's very hard to do time estimation well, especially if technology and new task is difficult. And so what I've observed in a case that I've studied is this company had perfect incentives. It worked. It was a premier Upwork kind of client. It worked with repeated, you know, in repeated contracting with people that it knew quite well. It talked to Wazoo, to these developers all the time, checking in. And yet, at the time of deadline, many times, the developer wasn't delivering what they contracted to deliver. As a result, the developer was losing money because there was a penalty for missing a deadline. But most importantly, the client couldn't complete the work for their customer. And the whole thing evolved around the fact that you cannot do this work in a predictable fashion. And that is known as a million man months problem from 1970s in IBM. And if you read about this problem, well, it is a coordination problem. It is a knowledge work problem. It's not a cross-boundary expertise problem. Everybody here is a developer. And the people hiring people in Upwork, at least the ones I studied, know as much about the task as the developers themselves. But they themselves would have as much trouble completing it at the timelines they need to. And what organization buys you, right, is this notion of constant adjustment and the notion of sort of working side by side and buying into common problems together. And if you think about ambiguity, unlike uncertainty, the inability to define what the problems are is never discussed, to the best of my knowledge, in economics literature. They just don't have terminology to deal with it. And so when you talk about information processing, it's all about uncertainty. It's never about ambiguity, and that's what's missing here. So finally, in incentive, again, a site I did study quite a bit. Inattentive is a platform where oftentimes scientific R&D problems are broadcast to a wide collective of scientists and engineers. Now it moved to design and technology, but like in general, that's where it started. And this is current challenge, so they're still doing something around science. You see that it's AstraZeneca, even the company's name is released. This is due January 2018. If anybody wants to try their hand, please feel free. $25,000 right there. So, and it's improving protein expression and optimizing protein purification is a problem. Now, if you read anything about Inattentive and how it works, it broadcasts this challenge, it offers this prize, anybody could compete right now. 17 people registered, meaning they downloaded the RFP, doesn't mean they're working on it. And usually about a dozen, depending on how hard the problem is, dozen solutions are submitted, and like the client's supposed to choose the best solution. Okay. So, what is the promise of Inattentive? And if you read about like scientific R&D and crowdsourcing, the whole idea is the following. The problems that grew up, let me use this word, in a particular context, in this case in AstraZeneca's labs probably. The internal scientists probably tried everything they can to solve it and couldn't. It's very rarely the issues that they're looking for, like extra resources or cost savings. Usually they've tried everything. And the reason you don't go to an incentive when you're just looking for cheap or quick solutions is because it exposes a lot of IP online by posting a problem. So with that said, they're posting stuff they could not solve within their domain of expertise. And then they're conducting what's called broadcast search or broad search. And people like Karim Lakhani or Deppa Thelin write about this notion that you don't know where the diversity of expertise comes from, so you broadcast it and waiting for scientists or whoever it is to come and solve this problem. And empirically, Lacani and Jefferson have a paper that shows that the problems are often solved by somebody marginal to the expertise of the solution seeker. So far, seekers are clients. So if you look at this problem, how many of you have expertise in this domain? Anybody? Okay. How many of you would try solving this problem with the expertise in the domain that you have? Right. That's the problem that an incentive has. It assumes that cross-boundary problem solving could be done by just broadcasting this problem. But the reality is, if you broadcast a problem like this, even if you tag it as engineering design or computer science IT, you know, some of us have expertise in IT and computer science. We are not going to try this because this problem is formulated in the domain in which it was created. And having been through two incentive workshops, because that was one of the sites I studied, they try their best to reformulate the problem in a way that appeals to a broad audience. But it's very, very hard and sometimes impossible to do that, preserving some details about the problem. It's particularly hard if you don't want to reveal the company name, don't want to reveal the context in which the problem is formulated for IP reasons. And you're just hoping that somebody will recognize from another domain some type of connections. And it does happen. The famous cases of when an incentive works, like predicting the solar storms, is when there is this recognition happening between somebody's expertise that is related but not exactly the same and the problem. But it's rare. It's sort of like, you know, stroke of genius kind of rare. Okay, so here we have the knowledge-based view problem, right? That the idea that you can sort of do this online outside the traditional expertise boundaries without building the glue, what I call it, building the connections. So with those three examples, the way I see this problem and I'm wrapping up is that sort of the question of who is going to make the investment in integrating stuff across boundaries, and it touches upon all three theories. Specifically, knowledge work, as most people in this room know or agree or at least partially agree, is embedded and historically situated in social practices with their own languages, cultures, identities, and interests. And it usually evolves around spanning certain hard-to-penetrate expertise boundaries. So once you build knowledge within those boundaries, it's hard to take it outside those boundaries. So like this chemistry example, right? These people know a lot about this problem, and they could formulate it the best they can in the most general chemistry terms. And I bet this formulation itself took days and days of thinking. But formulating it physics terms or formulating it in technology terms is hard because that's not what they do. It also promotes certain interests. And I don't just mean monetary interest, it's the expertise interest, right? So when you think about knowledge work that went on inside this R&D in pharma, right? It was around developing new chemistry techniques or new chemical engineering techniques. It wasn't around IT stuff that they are hoping to get a solver who just has the AI background to solve it somehow. And finally, for the process, it's not in the order I presented before, but there is a lot of information processing theories assume is that the managerial hierarchy exists for coordination and integration of information, but it completely forgets that in this integration, there is also interpretation. The interpretation is not something they worry about. And as a result, when you think about formulating and figuring out the problem in Upwork, the beauty of Upwork is that they already share the professional field, right? So we're not spanning the knowledge boundaries in the sense that we do in the other examples. But in the exchange of the information about deadlines, that's the key information being exchanged for coordination reasons, there is a lot of ambiguity in what we mean. You know, yes, I'll have it done. So for the simple case of when I use it for proofreading, right, I do get these responses where they say, yes, I can do your work. I can proofread / edit, you know, your paper in such and such time. And 90% out of 100, I expected way more than what I got delivered, right? Because I'm hoping people would read and understand and try cutting. What I get back usually is like a few more commas and a suggestion on rewriting two sentences, which is great. But the ambiguity of my problem definition is quite high. Say, I would like to have a very well edited paper. I'm willing to pay usually, however, like hourly rate. So I'm not trying to make incentives really tough on these people. I usually say like, just do it, you know, I'm willing to pay for it. And yet what they get back is usually not what I expected because of this ambiguity. And had we been working together in closer, I'm sure that many of my providers have the expertise to do it. What we don't have is sort of alignment of what it means to do the proofreading job. When I've seen in my research over the last I'd say I started looking into these things in 2009, is that gig economy for knowledge work tends to work when virtual organizing kind of resembles traditional organizing. In which way? It taps into existing fields of practice. So you hear in citizen science projects like OMS project, where you're really tapping into what mathematicians do anyway. You're just expanding who counts as a mathematician and have more people involved in proving theorems. When managers, workers, and consumers reside in the same social and digital space, which is Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia has so much going for it because everybody sort of, the roles are evolving about how to edit and who has the right to edit, but you're writing for yourself in some sense, right? And the managers are emergent people who've been writing well and who've been editing well. And don't tell me there are no managers in Wikipedia. Anybody who's looked at Wikipedia knows that there are roles and these roles matter. And the roles are reproduced, but they are sort of within this domain. It's sort of, instead of having what my colleagues imagine as this bad manager who wastes time, you just have a manager who is editing and choosing and sort of knows what you're doing and with a lot of respect for each other. And incentives are either pro-social or truly competitive. So what I mean here is we've studied OpenIDEO, which is a social innovation platform. I was in Law for Yard for the last 5 years. And indeed, it works beautifully for collaboration. People read each other's stuff, they comment, there is no fighting. We can't publish a paper because everybody expects flaming, which we do not see. Like people say, no, online communities must be flaming. No, people are truly motivated to make a world a better place. And people are often seeing the situations that they're helping resolve, like poor health in South America. And it works because you took care of William Sonian problem. Nobody there is opportunity seeking with Guile. From my 5 years of looking at it, nobody. Like if somebody comes there, like my students who have to do it for a grade, they maybe come in as opportunity seeking with Guile, as in I need to contribute to get an A in class. But they often leave saying, wow, this was profound and I want to do more of it. And, or truly competitive places. Yes, Kaggle and Top Coder, the programming communities, have communities. I'm not saying community is what allows this first thing to happen in the first place. It's an existing field of practice, right? So you have these programmers or, data scientists, and they have a community both offline and in case of Top Coder online, and in Kaggle a little bit online as well, where they talk to each other about sort of, but at the end of the day, it's a market. This is one of the best examples of true markets in knowledge works that we have seen. And the reason why it's a market is, if I go back to my very first teachers market example, in Kaggle, where you have a bunch of big data, a lot of data released, and then machine learners and data miners are competing on who produces the best solution in terms of prediction. You can see your pitches. You can see what you're buying. So it works just like this. The client controls what work is done. I need this done. Like, who can predict best on this data set? And the workers completely, not guided by the clients, figure out how to do that work. This is not how most of Upwork works. That's why we have the problems that I'm sure Greta and others will discuss in the afternoon. And it doesn't work like this, right? Where you basically have, you would have endless discussions and infighting what counts and what doesn't count. And with that, thank you. And I hope we have some good material to discuss.
And that's all for part one of episode 40. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time for more discussions from our symposium on continuities and disruptions in the management and work in the gig economy, here on Talking About Organizations.